Welcome to another episode of My Friend Pod with your host Paige Elkington and Ruby Caster. So on this episode, we are speaking with a gorgeous, impressive guest named Brendan Chamberlain-Simon. Brendan works at NASA, more specifically JPL, that's located here in Pasadena, Los Angeles. And Brendan started driving the Mars rover when he was 23, which is very impressive.
It's insane.
And he's also a very incredible musician and goes by the name Proud Father. And in this episode, we speak with Brendan about his job at NASA, how he got there, depression, success, foot fetishes, aliens, kinda.
Are they real? Are they not real? Tune in and find out.
That's right. With that, we're going to keep it short and we're going to just jump into this episode.
Which is not short. It's long to make up for all of the weeks that we've deprived you of episodes. I know you guys are just holding your breath and here it is.
We're on island time.
This podcast is on island time. Do not speak to us about a schedule. Don't speak to us about deadlines. Don't speak to us about anything. Okay, actually, but really do. Please follow us on Instagram and speak to us. We love you guys and thank you so much for listening.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Why don't we go ahead and introduce you to our listeners?
Sure. I'm Brendan. I'm from Chicago-ish. And I work for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is one of the NASA centers. And I'm a robotics technologist, and I am a rover planner, and I have a couple other jobs. We all get like 9 job titles, but those are 2 of mine.
Wow, and you're a musician.
And I'm a musician.
That goes by Proud Father.
That's right, yeah.
That's right.
Thanks for bringing that up.
I think you forgot.
Thanks for bringing that
up.
Yeah,
I can tell.
I appreciate that.
Did you always have an innate interest in space?
Yeah, I like wanted to do it since I was maybe 3, 4.
What specifically did you want to do?
I wanted to be an astronaut.
You want to be an astronaut.
Which admittedly,
classic.
I'm not doing that, so.
Yeah, but you know what? You're basically doing it.
In some regards.
In some way, you're interacting with space more than anybody else who doesn't work at NASA.
Something that is kind of like a fun thing that I get to claim is like there are fewer people that drive the rover than are astronauts.
Oh,
so
my
in
God.
A way, it's like,
wow,
that's so cool.
Shoot for the moon, even if you miss.
You land up in the stars.
That's right.
That's what
right.
They say. Okay, so before we go any further, Ruby and I had a really serious, pressing question.
A question that I was like, okay, I'm going to ask this and like maybe we'll sign an NDA.
We will sign an NDA. So just let us know.
Yeah, just let us know.
Cool.
We can edit it out.
Yeah.
If it's classified.
Based on your experience working at NASA, can you confirm or deny that girls go to Mars to get more stars and boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider?
I thought there was something with Venus.
And that was another question. I'm so glad you brought it up.
And the penis, right?
And the penis. Okay.
Because I, where I was raised, I thought it was boys go to Venus to get
a penis.
A penis.
Okay.
Girls go to Jupiter to get more stupider.
Wow.
But listen, I'm from the Midwest, and there's some pretty toxic value systems happening over there.
All right. So maybe we won't dive super deep into that because I don't know how much time we have.
Did that answer your question? Or?
I mean, listen, you would know more than we would because we're not.
Do you have the original? What is it actually?
What is the
I had to look up the original because when Ruby was first bringing up her expression that's, I guess, unique to Rhode Island. Down in the South, in Tennessee, where I'm from, I remember this. Boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider. Girls go to college to get more knowledge. Does this ring familiar?
That could be it, too.
That might be it, too. Yeah.
But was also originally known in other parts of the world as boys go to college to get more knowledge. Girls go to Venus to get more penis.
See, that seems kind of crazy, right?
Is that like a sexual?
We gotta set the story straight.
Like, we're going to have sex.
We were really young. I don't think we were saying like, I'm trying to get dick. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's crazy.
That's some grown people talk.
Yeah. Okay. We'll circle back.
We will sign an NDA because I have a feeling that this.
I don't, you're probably not allowed
to
disclose
that. I feel like you're
that.
Not giving us the full story for a reason.
You'll notice I'm a little bit cagey about.
Yeah,
this
I get
topic.
That. No, I get it. Yeah.
So you grew up in Chicago. You love space from a young age. And then what steps did you take to get to where you are now?
Oh, I was really a dweeb about it. It was very premeditated journey. I remember planning out my class schedule in middle school because I was like, this is what I want to do. And there's like a trajectory that I'm supposed to be on. So like if I take these classes when I'm in sixth grade, by the time I'm in 10th grade, I'll be taking this class. And then that'll catapult me. It was like really dweeby and nerdy. And I really this was trying
to
just...
a bit of a savant. That's incredible. I mean, savant is maybe an exaggeration. But like,
you had, well, you had
to be that hyper-focused. Yeah, you had to have the foresight.
At the time, it was just like what I was up to, and I didn't think twice about it. And now I look back on that and I'm like, that is so unrelatable. Who does that? Who does?
Yeah, but look at where you are. There are a lot of people who probably had similar aspirations at that age, but just didn't have the focus or understanding of what it would take. I think oftentimes that's like people's biggest downfall is that they're like, I want to do these things and I have no idea. They don't have the regiment.
I mean, I feel like
the
children, in their defense, like when you're young, you're like, I want to be an astronaut. And then you go play in the woods and you forget about it.
Yeah.
Were your parents like super excited that they had this ultra focused child?
It's a funny thing. I've come to like think about it more in different terms as of late. I think the reason I initially got into it was because I thought that the spacesuits were really cool. And then I started playing baseball because I thought the uniforms were really cool. And it's like perhaps a different parent might have been like, oh, he wants to be a fashion designer. He's a little bit misguided. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you really do.
You guys can't see him, but trust me.
He looks great.
Thank you so much. Let that show on the record. But it was a funny thing because I also really liked music, and music was kind of like in the running for me. But in the Midwest, the idea that you could make a living anywhere in the arts or anything even arts adjacent was like horrifying, impossible. Every parent in town was like, oh my God, no, do not do it.
Yes.
Do not do it.
Yes.
And so I think that the reason that NASA made a lot of sense for me was because it was the most kind of artful, romantic thing I could strive towards while still like being in the box of like
science.
Oh yeah, like this is like a technical government job.
Love the idea it too of it being
of
like
approval, you know
of
what
like
I mean?
Music is ridiculous and unattainable.
Astronaut,
go be an
for
astronaut.
It. Exactly. And truly that was how it was.
Great.
Being an astronaut seemed much more
feasible.
Yes, which is ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Obviously.
And yet,
but not
you're
for
doing
you.
Both.
And yet.
So
maybe, who knows? Wow.
I think pick something else like insanely, seemingly unattainable and go for it.
Yeah, what do you think the next thing should
now.
Be?
Did
you say I'm two? I'm maybe 1.5 for two.
I don't know.
Should I be a backup dancer?
You should be a backup dancer next.
Okay. I can't dance and have always wanted to.
I have a feeling you
perfect
probably
project
can.
For you.
Yeah, I think you could do it.
I feel like I'm going to talk to you in a year.
And I'll just be like, yeah, I'm actually...
You're like, I'm going on tour with J-Lo.
Yeah. I'm one of the people from the block.
In the back.
Yeah, hanging out.
Okay, so I have a more like technical and literal question is like, how did you end up at NASA? Like, what were the steps literally from getting out of school to being like, okay, let me call NASA and see if I can get an interview? Like, how does that...
I had this like trajectory in mind and it was, you know, a lot of physics and math and those things that you hear about. And I got lucky in a lot of different steps and stages, but I got really lucky in one, which is that when I was going to college, one of the offers I got, they were like, hey, and also we're going to give you a scholarship where you can work in any research lab you want and we'll fund it, which is very silly to offer to an undergrad because I had nothing to offer them in return. I just got to kind of be a liability.
What a dumb decision on their part.
It was really dumb. But I went in and I was like, oh, I'm going to work in this person who has worked for NASA before. I'm going to go do the space stuff. And I got there and they were like, oh, he's actually leaving. And I was like, my whole plan is foiled. He maybe had like retired or something like. But so it was like, okay, still have this scholarship thing where I can do research wherever I want. I guess I'll like find something that makes sense to me. And I was like, I guess I'll work in the robotics laboratory because that sounds kind of sick.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, again, they were like, you can go wherever you want. We'll fund it. And I was like, again, why? What are you talking about? I'll do it. Sure. But so I worked in this robotics laboratory when I was a freshman in college, which, it was a bunch of PhD candidates and me. And it was actually a computer science laboratory, but they were like, we want you to be like the hardware guy. We want you to like build stuff. And I had never built anything. I had such a pitiful level of experience. But the fear of embarrassment, such a powerful driver.
Oh, it really is. You read Robotics for Dummies overnight.
It was like that. What I could have done is like asked them for help, but I was too embarrassed to reveal how stupid I was.
Sure.
I think I did probably work like 80 hours a week in this lab for like years, where I was just kind of like sneaking back in at night and studying on my own to try and figure out how this stuff worked. And I got to the point where I like kind of was like, oh, actually, like I'm starting to click with this and I'm possibly going to maybe contribute on this team. Maybe, maybe.
So sick.
And then Curiosity landed on Mars in 2012. And I saw that and I was like, oh, maybe robotics is actually extremely relevant.
Yeah.
And I found JPL, which claims to be the robotic explorers of the solar system. And I was like, oh, the stars are kind of aligning. Maybe actually robotics is my path to working at NASA. And that was how I like found JPL, essentially. I had known about them before, but that was how they kind of got like situated in my, like, that's kind of my goal. Mm-hmm. And then I started driving that very rover 4 years later.
The math and the physics part of it, was that creative to you?
Yeah.
Right? So I'm always
loved it.
Okay.
I loved it a lot. And it's funny because in hindsight, I think that because I wanted to do this, the math and physics idea was kind of attached to my understanding of myself. Like it felt like this like identity driven pursuit of like, this is a thing I'm supposed to be good at. Mm-hmm. And I do remember, you know, getting like my first B in algebra in seventh grade and having a panic attack and being like, oh my God, do I suck? And having to push through something not innately, and you know, watching other people around me like do better. But then I remember finding like, by the time I was maybe like 17, and this sounds really corny in hindsight, but I remember looking at like math and physics and being like, there is so much like innate beauty to the way that this all works and the way that it can so reliably like describe the universe that we find ourselves in. And I like thought of it as almost like a spiritual practice. It felt very like I'm in dialogue with like the pursuit of capital T truth. And that was like really fun and satisfying for me.
Wow. Okay. That's wow. Did you have a social life?
Yeah, I think so.
80
yeah.
hours in the freaking lab?
They're like good grades.
Were you guys partying? Good. Like what's...
Well, this was Columbia, so not, you know, wasn't like banger of the century. There were always like good, was it good grades, good social life, good sleep? Is that what they say?
Yeah.
There's like that whole thing or whatever. I had been told that and I was like, sleep, boring, who needs it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I remember for that first year I was sleeping, I think like 5 hours a night. Which is not a lot for
That's
me.
Not a lot,
I'm kind of more of a 9 hour king these days.
Same. Wow. I love a 9 hour king.
Yeah. That was definitely very stressful and taxing. And then I had this moment of realization. I'm going to sleep the correct amount. And the thing that I'm going to miss is class. And my grades skyrocketed.
Really?
Like class, not for me. I'm giving a thumbs down.
Thumbs down. You guys can't see it. His
class did not
down.
Click for me. Wow. And I realized I was like, oh, this has been my time suck. Once I started to think of sleep as productive, if not more productive, than going to class, everything started to make sense for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's kind of sick.
Incredible.
I love this. Yeah. I love this hot take because it is not something that I think I ever hear people talk about who are at your level of success.
Love him or hate him, but I was just watching an interview with Jeff Bezos, not by choice. It like came up maybe on TikTok. And he was saying that his first meeting starts at 10 a.m. because he requires 9 hours of sleep. And then he likes to putter around in the morning.
Yeah.
And I was like,
that's the coolest thing I've ever heard him say.
Fascinating. I like to putter around in the morning.
I also like
are
to
you
putter.
A putterer?
I'm a putterer for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah. You can drive yourself crazy being like, I'm going to make my day as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
And I think that it's probably a zero-sum game if you're like really stressing about optimizing your life.
Totally.
That's no fun.
What is your day look like when you're manning this machine?
So basically the way that it works is there's this rover on Mars, and a couple things need to happen for that rover to be operated. Number one is that it has to have enough battery power. to do the things we are asking it to do. Mm-hmm. And unlike some previous rovers, the rovers that we currently have on Mars are nuclear powered. So they have something called an RTG, which is a radioisotope thermoelectric generator.
Oh, we knew.
And basically it's like this, it's this brick of plutonium essentially. And that, as it radioactively decays, is a reliable source of heat. And we use that heat to trickle charge a battery on the rover. The relevant thing here, it's always getting power, but it's very slow.
Are you powering this? Okay.
Yeah. So it's like you're plugged into like the worst wall charger in the world, but you're always plugged in.
So it's a sustainable form of power.
Exactly. It just needs time to charge, but it's a reliable form of power. So that's one aspect of it, is the power of it. Another aspect of it is data. Mars is pretty far away. So if we're going to talk with the rover, it takes one way time is like, I think it's somewhere between like 4 and 20 minutes or something.
Okay.
For just the signal to get one way.
Wow.
Which is, you know, not nothing.
That's supposed to be impressive, right?
I don't know. It's just what it is.
I was like, seems like a while.
It's just what it is. It's like, that's like speed of light kind of thing. That's just how far away it is. I think a lot of people who expect it to be like a joystick kind of thing,
like
even if everything else was perfectly doable, that lag is extreme.
Yeah.
And so it's not really, you know, a super viable approach. But on top of that, it's not so trivial to be able to send data to, and more relevantly, from the rover to Earth. When we send a signal to the rover, we'll use something called the Deep Space Network, which is a series of satellites. There's a facility in Goldstone, California. There's a facility in Canberra, Australia, and there's a facility in Madrid. And basically those are situated such that no matter what orientation the Earth is, we can point these satellites to anywhere in the solar system, no matter what the rotation of the Earth is at any moment. One of those satellites can always see.
Yeah. So the current distance from Earth to Mars is 76.4 million miles.
Yeah. That sounds right.
That's
very
really,
far.
Really, really, yeah, far. Really far.
It's really far.
So having that be roughly 8 minutes back and forth.
Yeah.
Is like kind of impressive, I think. But yeah, like, I guess
it's,
compared
it's
to
crazy
what?
That
compared
it works.
What,
it's know? Crazy it's like, that it works at all, that we can send it that far.
Yeah.
So it'll send signal to the orbiter, and then the orbiter will send that signal back to the Deep Space Network, and then the Deep Space Network will send it back to JPL. So there's this whole chain of signal that has to happen, and the sort of literal stars have to align for the rover to be able to see the orbiter, and then for the orbiter to be able to see the DSN, because Mars gets in the way. And so it basically means there are discrete instances in any given day in which we are able to communicate with Mars. It's usually like something like 3 a day. We have multiple orbiters.
Wow. And over here, I was just thinking you were like driving a remote control car around.
Yeah. It's not like we have instantaneous direct access to it.
No,
it is like,
as you stated,
and something that is interesting about it is like those orbiters like have their own scientific interests and also like service other spacecraft on Mars. So like we have to even like negotiate with those orbiters for like, can we get this data pass, please?
Wow, really?
We want this one, please. Yeah, which is really interesting.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, it's you know, it's an arduous thing to get the data back. But so what that boils down to basically is we do something that we call scripted autonomy, which basically means that we will create an entire day's worth of plans for the rover to execute at a time. We will send it. It will essentially operate while we sleep. And then we'll wake up the next day and we'll have the data back and we'll say, oh, this is how it did.
So when you say plans, like, let's break it down. Like, what the heck is this Mars rover even doing?
So there are two rovers up there right now that are
named.
We have Curiosity.
We got Curiosity and we've got
Perseverance. And they're doing a little bit different things. Curiosity, which is what I learned to drive on. So it's my kind of...
That's your baby.
That's my baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now I actually only drive Perseverance, so.
Wow, whoops. You just like left sort Curiosity of,
kind
in
of
the dark.
Yes. Yeah.
Little upgrade.
Curiosity, we call the robotic geologist. And so it was basically driving around in this site called Gale Crater, and it was taking samples of the ground and was doing in-situ sample analysis. So it would take these samples, we'd put them onto onboard science instruments, and then we'd send that data back and we'd be like, hey, look. According to our onboard science instrument, the chemical composition of that sample looks like this. Cool. Look at the mineralogy. Amazing. And then super smart science people would say, this means that, or that means this.
And this is how they like found water. No.
No. a lot of the water stuff has to do with like actual like orbital observations.
Got it.
And that's how we kind of do like our site selections of like, oh, this okay. is where we want to get more of a stratigraphic analysis. Essentially, we are like climbing from the base of an ancient lake bed up a mountain. And with each layer, it's a different era in time based okay. on like the, you know, the drying up of the lake. And so mm-hmm. it's like a very kind of like geologist approach to how can we sort of date the history of the geology. That's right. what we're up to with that one.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. the other one is doing something kind of interesting, which is that it's taking these samples and then it's leaving them on the surface of Mars. And we actually just dropped off a bunch of the samples on the surface. And a future mission is going to pick them up and bring them back to Earth. And we're going to analyze them here on Earth.
Let's see what's happened.
What's like the overall, I mean, I'm sure there's a thousand objectives. So maybe this is a dumb question. Like, what's the dream expectation from,
yeah, I think
from
that,
collecting
like,
this
the
data?
The ultimate like stated goal of NASA is like we are trying to determine either ancient or extant extraterrestrial life in the solar system. And so what we're doing on Mars, I think, is determining its geological history.
History, right.
So that we can make a determination of the viability of life, both past and present, on the planet.
So you guys are trying to like craft kind of like a history book.
Essentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, much in the same way that we do
the Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very similar style of analysis.
Sure.
But admittedly, and this is one of the funny things about having my job, is when you get into like the science side of it, I'm like, I don't really know, because I am an engineer and not a scientist.
Right.
And the people who are scientists, whenever I'm in meetings with them, I'm like, you guys sound really smart.
You're like, I'm designing the thing that's going to gather the data, and then you guys dissect it and make sense of it. Right.
Like you'll come in every day and you'll like see the brand new imagery from mm-hmm. the surface of Mars, mm-hmm. and I'll be like, dope, it's like a bunch of rocks.
Yeah.
And the scientists will be like, oh my God, look at this one.
Is this a job you can do hungover?
I will tell you, and all the taxpayers, I never have. I think it's because...
He's not even winking right now.
Yeah, he's being dead ass.
He's being dead ass.
Here's the thing about it. It costs $2.5 billion. And that's a lot.
Annually?
No. The mission costs $2.5
billion. Oh my God. I was like...
No. But it costs $2.5 billion. And this is going to sound corny.
No, it's
but
not.
But like,
we love a corny moment.
There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people who have like spent their entire careers getting this thing up there. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason... I started when I was 23, which is so funny. They entrusted a 23-year-old kid to be like, okay, you get the, like the honorable
Obviously,
job at the end of the
smart,
gate.
Brendan.
Well,
they weren't just like, oh, let's pull this.
I mean,
that's actually
willy-nilly,
fucking wild. But it's wild to have a project of that magnitude with that many dollars behind it and then give you
It's
like,
a testament to your intellect.
It's more a testament to the amount of fail-safes it has. Like, I couldn't really mess it up that bad, I think.
Interesting.
When I first started doing it, I remember like the first day I ever drove the rover, it was like taking the SAT. Like, I sweat through my clothes, I like skipped lunch. When I was walking back to my car in the parking lot after, I cried. Like,
oh,
it was just such a like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah.
What the hell? Now it's just like my job. I've been doing it for 7 years.
Like, normal clothes? Or do you have to wear like lab coats?
It depends what I'm doing. I always like when I get to throw on a lab coat.
Yeah.
Wish that you were like, listen, if I'm going to sign this contract, I want to wear the astronaut suit.
You gotta let me in the suit.
That's what got me in.
You gotta let me in the suit. Sometimes, like if you're in like a particular lab where there's like, you know,
special lab coat,
hazardous stuff, or whatever, you wear like the full mask respirator and like a bunny suit and like big boots and so, you know, it's not comfortable at all. Like for the first minute, there was this one place I got to work where I was working in like a fake moon, but they had like a basically like a giant bin of like moon dust.
Where was this?
This is in Florida at Kennedy Space Center.
Cool.
And the first minute was like so cool. And I was like, oh my God, I'm walking on the moon.
Yeah.
And the second to every other minute, I was like, it's hot. It's hot. This sucks.
Yeah.
This is not that fun.
Side note, can Ruby and I come tour JPL?
Actually, you can.
Really?
Because I was supposed to go years ago. I had made an appointment. And then I think that you have to use your full legal name. And I go by
FBI.
You made a general appointment?
I don't even remember. It was so long ago.
One of the cool privileges I have is like I can actually just like give people escorted tours. But
yes.
And I'm saying this on the record for everybody to know. One of the rules about it is it can't be like in exchange for anything. It just has to be a...
Oh, so just for tour. Sex.
Exactly. Like, I could never...
We were...
So, like, you could not could have sex with us.
In the parking
correct.
Lot.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Absolutely correct. Well, I would be canned immediately.
We could just Google it, I guess.
Do you know who Jack Parsons is?
I do, yeah. Should we talk about Jack
Speaking
Parsons?
Speaking of sex.
I
truly. It's the perfect segue.
It is
the
perfect
segue. I mean, that's the reason I know about JPL. Is
oh, really?
Because of Jack Parsons. Because I found him... such a fascinating person. I actually gave Ruby
do you think it was an accident or no?
I actually kind of do.
Whoa.
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
Wait, why don't we, can we talk about...
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, that was kind of
context.
A...
context.
Yeah, so Jack Parsons is one of the original founders of the laboratory, but he's like this alchemist, occultist, had this like cool, yeah. like furious, dark energy.
He and was super like, obsessed with like magic, sex magic.
Yeah, and was like having like all kinds of sex parties.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
By all accounts, cool dude.
Cool dude.
Cool dude.
Really shunned for his like wild lifestyle.
Very much so. NASA is, as you might imagine, a pretty buttoned up agency.
Community. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he apparently in one of his experiments blew himself up. And that's how he died. I think he was like in his maybe 30s or something.
Yeah.
And a lot of his like friends were like, say what you will about Jack. He was the most
smart,
careful,
cautious
man. Laboratory worker we had ever met. There's no way this would have ever happened. And so some people think that, you know, Uncle Sam got involved. Not to say I necessarily yeah. believe anything in particular.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that NASA is an interesting thing because it is very, very in dialogue with nationalism. It's like an image-driven thing.
It's why people think that we faked the moon landing to yeah. like oh, boost for morale sure. in yeah. the 60s.
Which we
got to
talk about that, too.
Totally. It's really interesting just because like ultimately the genesis of it was the space race, which was essentially like a political kind of proxy
yep.
battle. And I think that it's very tied up in people's understanding of this is what a functional society is capable of. This is what my government does for me. This is the forefront of what humanity is capable of. I think people bring a lot of their own relationship with their self and with the truth and with their country
in America
into like how they think about NASA
totally.
And so I think that I could envision I don't know how it was back then, obviously I was not alive, but I could envision that they were like, Jack Parsons, great for technical progress, bad for the narrative.
Also, he wasn't he friends with L. Ron Hubbard?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And he got scammed by L. Ron Hubbard. He scammed Jack into thinking they were going to buy and resell a yacht. So he got all this money from Jack. And then he then took that money and started Scientology with it.
That's pretty cool.
Anyway, just a little
kind of an
epic
W for L. Ron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge W.
Hell huge yeah. W. Also, so, all of Hollywood, huge W for L. Ron.
For him to just be like, the person I'm going to scam is yeah. noted goat mode
yeah.
rocket scientist.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Pretty yeah. crazy.
Pretty cool.
I love that.
So do people, with your job being your job, what are the questions people tend to ask you a lot? Do people ask you about aliens a lot?
I get aliens about every time.
So I want to ask you those exact same
sure.
questions that you get asked every day.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that are
yeah.
really
something
of.
That I like to do when people start to ask questions that I don't like is I like to pretend like I can't talk about it.
I love that.
It's kind of a useful defense.
And it's great because they think they're getting information. If you're like, I actually can't talk about that. They're
yeah,
like, there are aliens.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
there are aliens. He's met them.
Yeah, it's really funny.
You're in a relationship with one.
It's such a funny job to have. I remember thinking when I got it, I was like, well, I'm getting laid every night.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Certainly. Please tell me that's the truth.
Yeah, come
it's,
on.
I genuinely, at this stage of my life, prefer to not bring it up. I really like it if it goes unsaid and we never talk about it. And it's just because it's actually, unless you want to have like a long form conversation about it, it's really like a weird, not relatable job.
When I first met you in our friend Zoe's kitchen that night,
yeah.
I remember we were chatting about something and you said that you lived in New York and I lived in New York and we were like, oh, we overlapped and da, da, da. And then I think I was like, what do you do? And you're like, oh, I drive the Mars rover. And I was like, cool, I used to do that. Like, I thought you were fucking with
me. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So I was like, that's so weird. I used to do that. Like, what are the odds? Like, we have so much in common. We both lived in New York. It's we cool, both drove the rover. Like, I fully thought you were just fucking with me. So, and then it went on and he was like, no, I actually work for NASA. And I was like, cool. Thinking he's just kidding because that's so not a thing anyone has ever said. Like, no, I don't, right, it's not like, right. Oh yeah, like a ton of people just work there that I know and this is a normal thing. So I totally thought you were just fucking with me until later in the evening, another person was like, yeah, he actually works for NASA. And I was like, wait, what? I got so embarrassed because I was,
you know what's really
so
funny
dismissive thinking you were just fucking is with me.
That, I don't think it was that same night, but a night, a couple nights later, I think, mm-hmm. Becky...
Yeah.
Claimed that she was a chiropractor. And I didn't know Becky very well at all. Uh-huh. And I fully bought into it and consented to her giving me an adjustment like on the ground of this party.
I hope she was wasted.
She was not a great truth for me.
Yeah.
But she was like making moves.
Yeah.
Things were cracking.
Things were cracking.
Wow. And I,
you're like, I haven't been able to walk.
I got up and then she like confessed and I was like, that was illegal. Like, yeah. What? What? Like, oh my God.
That's really funny.
Yeah. So I think it's good to have a healthy skepticism when somebody tells you what they do.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
it's
like so you're right to think that. But yeah, I definitely do carry a business card around because sometimes it's helpful.
I bet.
It's more off-putting than you might suspect.
I mean, maybe I'm not the right demo for that. Cause like for me, that would be such a, I would latch on. I would punish you. You know what I mean?
That's,
like, you'd
okay.
be in the corner.
I think that is the thing. Is like,
and you'd be like, I need to go pee. And I'd be like, okay, cool. And I'd follow you.
It's, I mean, half actually, I would never people do that to who anyone, are but... disinterested and half punishers.
Yeah, yeah. Punishers for
and,
sure.
And yeah, so it is sort of like a fast track to like...
One or the other.
Yeah, when I announce that, it's like, let me surround myself with punishers for the night. But the other thing is like my... There are like certain aspects of my job that I think are very interesting. Like I was living on Mars time for a while. I think that's really interesting.
Okay,
we can talk about that.
What is Mars time?
Yeah, what the hell?
Let me finish the other point, which is most of it is not. Like if I was just like, yeah, I'm an engineer doing, I don't know, like HVAC, you'd be like, bummer, dude.
Bye. Yeah.
So the actual like nitty gritty of what I'm doing a lot, I think is not innately interesting. But some of the human elements of it are, for Mars time, very funny. I was a helicopter integration engineer for Ingenuity, which was the helicopter that we sent to Mars with Perseverance. I don't know that I can technically claim this because when I say I drive the rover, there's a huge team of people that help. But when it comes to where we drive, I'm writing the code and I'm selecting the waypoints and like really like inarguably, I'm driving it. I technically was like the first person to quote unquote fly the helicopter, but it's so much more of a finger quotes thing because it was so much more of the work was done for me. And I was kind of like really, truly just like the end of the chain.
Mm-hmm,
right. But I did so get to fly the Mars helicopter for the first time, which was
holy
very,
shit.
Very cool.
Wow. So what was up with that?
We landed on Mars in 2021 in February. And a little something was happening back then called COVID-19. Unvaccinated era.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes. Was you saying this is pre-vax?
This is pre-vax.
Okay. Right.
And it was already like such a daunting task to like get it up there. We were like, there's no way that we're going to do this remote. Oh my God, no.
Yeah, there's no way.
And so we were one of the first people to just be like, well, let's see how it goes.
Yeah.
And it was two or three masks kind of vibe. Everybody's surrounded in plexiglass.
Wow.
We're wiping everything down.
Right.
But we also were on Mars time. So a Mars day is 24 hours and 38 minutes, which sounds close, and it is close, but it's actually very annoying because when we're concerned with the rover, we want to operate the rover during the Mars day. And that's because A, it's light out, so we can take images, and B, it's a lot warmer during the day. And so the amount that we have to heat our components is a lot less. So it's a much better, more energy efficient way to do things.
There?
It's very chilly. Mm. The temperature fluctuates a lot from day to night. So right. In the day, it can get like up to like rather Earth-like temperatures. Uh-huh. But the temperatures that we design for on the low end are like -140 degrees Celsius.
Shit.
Which is really cold. And there's like a difference between designing things to survive at those temperatures and to operate at those temperatures. Uh-huh. And so we're like, we survive the night, we operate during the day. And so we, on that cadence, it's like we're much more concerned with like the Mars sunrise and sunset than the Earth one. And when we first land, it's really important that we do things like as efficiently as possible, and we get data back as often as we can, and we respond with something called a ground in the loop cycle, which is where we get data back, we can respond to it, and we can tweak our future plans. We want to optimize those as much as we can. Mm-hmm. So we go in Mars time, which is where we wake up with the Mars sun set, do our plans during the Martian night, and then go to sleep as the Mars sun is rising, and then we sleep during the Martian day.
So mm-hmm. like, do you go on your iPhone under like, you know, clocks, and then
here's
like,
something that Mars. I'm a little bit miffed about, because I heard, and I'm not positive on this, I heard for some of the older Mars missions they made
watches,
like Rolex watches, like that were like special. I don't know if they're actually Rolex watches, but you know, they made like cool analog watches that were like 24-hour, 38-minute watches.
So
which
sick.
Is so sweet.
Yeah.
For us, they're like, we made an app. And I'm like, thank you. That is helpful.
That should be part of your merch.
But like, I do want...
You should get that.
Yeah. They're actually, I think a company did make...
Did make these?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So they're like available for sale. And I think it got posted like in one of our like Slack channels. Like, hey, you can buy these if you want. And they were like, you know, like $20,000. And everybody was like, no.
We
can't
good.
Afford that. We work here. We're not a very perk heavy place.
Do you guys have like a snack room?
Here's the thing. We have to pay for our own coffee.
Shut up.
I know. But people always are like, what?
Wow, this is not like the Google offices.
I don't have like a kitchen. There's a cafeteria, which I also have to pay for a la carte. And it is not especially cheap.
What the hell?
What's the female-male ratio of people working? Is it male-dominant?
It depends on the area of work. In my section, which is the robotics section, which tends to be kind of like research-heavy,
it is
overwhelmingly male-dominated.
Yeah.
In the Mars surface operations universe, which is rover driving, a lot more of a balanced scale.
Interesting.
We're working on it.
I was more asking, like, is there sexual tension in the office? That's why.
Is there like office gossip of like so and so is hooking up with blah blah blah?
I'm sure that there is.
You're just not privy to it.
I don't know. I'm not privy
See,
to
the
it.
Reason
I don't think I'm like in the in crowd.
Got it.
Wow, you're not in like the hip cool crowd.
No, I get an impression that there are like kind of like crews of people where it's like all of our friends work here, and we're like, you know,
right,
like kind of like a Big Bang Theory kind of vibe.
Okay,
got it.
And I
you're
am
like
not
you're like the cool musician kid.
Wait,
you
how old are you also make music? Currently
I'm 29.
So
what do I look?
Infant.
No, you look really great. I was about to say, like, you are not giving me a tired work all the time vibe at all. You look very put together, very...
Thank you.
Very cute.
Well, I will say something that is nice about the idea of NASA is that it's a place that capitalizes very, very heavily on experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's a super, super specialized thing to do, and experience is really important. And as a result, there is a genuine like prioritization in sustainability for our employees. The average amount of time that people work at JPL is 17 years, which is extremely long. In my senior year of college, I remember I was doing this project where I built a robot that played darts automatically, which was very funny.
Wow.
And I was working
How precise was it?
Bullseyes. It was so cool.
This is what the world needs.
We were like getting our projects approved, and the person in front of me was like, yeah, like I have this idea for like, it's like a water purification system or whatever. And the advisor was like, I don't know, like doesn't really sound like a good mechanical problem. Like maybe come up with something else. And then I was like, I want to make a robot that plays darts. And they were like, hell like, yeah, do it. So I did. But I was working probably like 100 hours a week developing genuine health problems. It was bad. And then I started working at NASA 11 days after I graduated. And I remember when I started, they were like, please don't work more than 40 hours a week. And I was like, how? What do you mean? How am I supposed to do that? And it was genuinely uncomfortable for me to work as little as they wanted me to when I first started. But now I've like...
I wonder if it's part of it is just like you need to be well rested for like, kind of like what we were saying earlier, kind of joking, like, can you go to work hungover? It's like, no, because there is so much at stake. If something went wrong, like maybe they just don't want people to be literally loopy from not sleeping enough.
That's a funny thing about the Mars time thing is like, because Mars time's a crazy thing to, by the way, to clarify what that is. It's like you're waking up 45 minutes later every day. So you start on like the day shift, and then gradually you get to the night shift. and then you keep wrapping around. And so every month you go through a full cycle where you've woken up at like every time possible for work, which is very weird and very weird to do during COVID. But they would have cots for us because they'd be like, hey, this is really weird and really weird on your body. And if you need a hotel or if you need a ride home or if you want to sleep in a cot, like whatever. But we would always joke, like, we can't drive our cars home, but we can drive a $2.5 billion rover. Yeah, like, yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah.
But fortunately, like there are so many checks and balances.
That's great.
It's not a system that like enables loopiness.
Great.
That's super
great.
Well.
Good to know.
Yeah.
So do you think that the employees stay so long at JPL? Maybe this is a dumb question, but because there's like not so many other places to work?
No, it's not a dumb question. I mean,
like there's SpaceX. Like where else can you work?
There's a couple places. In the robotics section, we're losing a lot of people right now to Amazon.
Oh, to Amazon. Because
it's just people that are just doing robotics. Yeah. So like everybody that does space stuff, like usually it will have like some other kind of
robotics
area of expertise.
Okay.
And there are, for the lion's share of what those are, like there's some industry parallel, whether that's like digital communications or I'm a thermal engineer or, you know, I do structures or whatever. Yeah. Like there's usually a private space analog. But I think that a lot of the people that work at JPL really wanted to work there specifically. And it's just, you know, it's the thing that they want to do. It's how they like understand themselves. It's a big, oh, this job is a real part of my identity mm-hmm. type job. Mm-hmm. And that's not one that people often tend to leave.
What do you think about SpaceX and Elon's Mars mission?
I don't love it. So
why don't you love it?
I have an interesting kind of complicated relationship with all of this, which I think evolves all the time. I think that in general, the idea of massive enterprises in general are sort of at the whims of billionaires and are product of massive income inequality. I don't love that. That's not my favorite.
I don't love that either.
And whether, you know, they are good or bad or right or wrong and how they choose to spend their massive accrued wealth, I think I take issue with the massive accruement of wealth to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that kind of bumps for me about it. I think the other thing that's been kind of a little bit frustrating for me lately, there is kind of this idea of like colonize Mars, which right. by the way, why use that word? Pick a better word. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like colonizing is bad. We know that.
Yeah.
And I think like there's this kind of idea of like, oh, it's like our backup for totally. When we fuck up Earth or something.
Yeah.
And I'm like, in what world is nuking Mars and like retrofitting some weird space station better than just figuring out how to live sustainably on the planet that we have evolved to live on
right.
for millions of years?
Right. We're
it was made for us.
Statistics.
Or we were made for it, rather.
But the water and how bad it is. And it's like, we could fix that
could fix
with
that.
So much less money than
yes.
we could go to Mars.
Yes. And I think that all that being said, I do think that NASA is there's a lot of beauty to it. There's a lot of romance to it. I think it's a really compelling human enterprise. Mm-hmm. I really, really, really just on a personal level like the idea of that being a public enterprise
yep.
rather than a private enterprise. I think yeah. that it is so much more meaningful if it is a public enterprise.
I agree.
Yeah, I just like that.
Makes sense.
And I think it being a high-minded public science, public art thing,
yes,
instead of a profit-driven enterprise, I think is for
it's
the better.
Good. I think you just said it really well. Let's keep something pure. I mean, to yeah. some degree. We've talked about your job a lot, but I wanted to talk about your music too.
Yeah, let's talk about your music.
Sure.
So throughout all of this, you've been making music, or when did you start making music?
Yeah, I've been making music the whole time, pretty much. It's very important to me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I get to be one of the like very few people where it's like my NASA job funds my music, which is kind of hilarious, you know, like the accounting looks really funny because believe you me, my music project is hemorrhaging cash.
Yeah. You got pedals
oh, it's
galore.
Deeply in the, oh, I'm stacked with pedals, overloaded, stuffed to the gills with pedals. But I've always thought of myself as a musician, but then I had a really interesting emotional experience when I started driving the rover, which is to say I became very depressed. Most depressed I've ever
okay,
been.
Okay, negative emotional.
Negative, yeah. Well, there were a flurry of positives, like, you know,
sure,
it yeah. was an amazing thing. But I just kind of went through the ringer in terms of like every wrong idea a person could ever have about where fulfillment comes from. I think I had them all. And
ooh, yeah. Did you think that you were just going to be immediately satisfied when you this, like,
I literally thought it was like, I'm going to get this job and I will never be sad ever again and the streets will be paved with gold for me.
Yeah.
Right. And it's always going to live in my back pocket. Amazing. And it did not feel that way at all. I had had the same goal for my entire life.
Your whole life.
And then, admittedly, fortunately, by virtue of having achieved it, but nonetheless, I did not have a goal anymore. It was the first time in my life that I had no goals.
And you were 23.
I was 23, and I was over... There's this lyric on this album that I wrote, which was, how long can I run victory laps before it feels like I'm running in circles? And I was just kind of like, am I just going to be kind of like a former spaceman forever? Like, is that all I'm going to do, is just be defined by this thing I did when I was 23, and my life is over now, and I'm just kind of chilling? And it felt very existentially dreadful. Mm-hmm. And I think that was enhanced by... the like relief of it felt super high. Sure. And not to be dismissive of other people who kind of like reach the top of their mountain. Those all, I think, feel the same way.
Yeah.
But for me, it was like, oh, my mountain was like going to another planet. That's a pretty big mountain.
It's a pretty big mountain.
And I was really nervous that every other mountain that I would attempt to climb would feel...
it would pale.
Minuscule.
Yeah.
I was like... So I was really just so worried that I was like, oh, I'm done. It's over. Like,
by the way, I feel like that's a common theme when with people who find a large amount of success, especially at a younger age.
Yes.
I feel like almost makes things more complicated versus people who find success in like their 50s, mm-hmm. their 60s or whatever. It's such a different trajectory. And you have that time to naturally find out that happiness and success are, one, not correlated, and also it's not linear, right?
Totally. It's been very comforting in hindsight to realize like that is a very common human experience. Totally. And I think a lot of it is just like the way that we are trained, or rather maybe like not trained, to like seek fulfillment in ways that feel sustainable.
Yes.
I think like I was just so used to the education system where it's like all about growth and it's all about gold stars and like external validation.
And you got the pinnacle gold star.
I hit the ceiling and then there were no more gold stars and no more growth. And I was like, holy shit.
And so how did you lean into music?
Yeah. So I was just so deep in it. And I was having this problem where whenever I would try, and I was like, you know, like going to therapy and like just trying to like figure everything out. And whenever I would try and like really wrestle with it in like emotion space, there would be this other voice in my head that was like, what are you talking? Like, you're so lucky. You're incredibly lucky. So many people have supported you, have helped you get to this point. You're being unbelievably ungrateful.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. And I couldn't turn that part of my brain off. And so whenever I would like try and just like process these emotions, that louder part of my brain,
you're being ungrateful.
Like,
you're being ungrateful.
Just cut it off. And it made progress very hard. And so I came up with this idea. Ideas almost always feel by accident. I feel like I came up with this idea of like, I'm going to write an album about the first person to go to Mars. And that made it feel like I could complain. Oh, you're the first person to go to Mars and you get there and it's boring and lonely.
Yeah.
And you're like, shit. I thought a lot about getting here, but I didn't think about arriving here or being here and like looking back at Earth with my primary emotion being like wistfulness. Didn't think about that. Shit. I think it's just easier for me to give grace to somebody else than myself. But it's entirely allegorical for like all of the ways that I felt. But like the album was essentially about a journey of purpose that descends into this feeling of tremendous purposelessness, kind of like an anti-hero's journey kind of thing. And the cool thing that happened to me is the album about purposelessness became my purpose. I just sunk my teeth into it so dearly. I felt like I was like, I have such a unique vantage point on this particular thing that I'm talking about. This is so my story to tell. I'm supposed to tell it. It feels urgent.
You're uniquely suited to,
it felt like urgent to disclose. And it was like the greatest therapy in the world. Incredible. It was like such a sandbox for me. And truly have felt good ever since.
Really?
Yeah.
I
like
I was
like,
kind of going to ask and be like, so now are you like feeling like way better? Like
crazy.
Being able to put it in a place?
It's crazy how much it stuck. And this is like also just like a classic thing with depression. I feel like when you experience depression, I think for the first time, there is this idea of like, oh, it's going to be like this forever.
Forever.
I'll never get out of this. Mm-hmm. And that I think is probably the most, for me at least, was the most daunting thing about it. And so to be able to climb out of it even once and to know if I ever fall back into it, I could in theory climb out again.
Mm-hmm.
That alone has been like enough to even keep me from falling back into it.
I like that you just said that because I struggle with anxiety in that same way that a lot of people have, like with depression, where they go through bouts of it, where sometimes my anxiety is so bad. And what keeps me from completely just, I think, losing my mind is knowing that I've climbed out of it before. My anxiety spells are way further apart than they used to be, where I would just be like, when I was younger, I would just feel like I was always anxious. Now I'm like, when I can feel the, just like the thought patterns that take me there, I'm like, oh no, you've done this before and it sucks. And also it's okay. The fear of it happening doesn't overwhelm me as much because I know I have the tools to get out of it.
Do you remember the first time it clicked for you where you were like, oh, I got out of that.
Yes.
And therefore I can get out of that.
Yes.
What was that like when it clicked?
It felt like completing a puzzle with like one piece that had just been missing the whole time. And then I finally put the piece in. It was like I was looking at a puzzle that was incomplete, thinking I will never find this piece, and then I found it and I was like, oh, there it is. And now if I were to have an unfinished puzzle again, I know all the pieces are there.
Cool. I,
you
like
know
that. Yeah,
I'm like, that's, I just really, have to like put them back in, you know.
That's such a good analogy.
That's
really
great.
Like
that's
that.
What it felt that's a really good analogy. Have you thought of that before?
That
was that off the cuff?
It was off the cuff.
That was off the cuff.
Yeah, you guys can take
that's
it.
That's staying in.
Yeah, keep it.
Do you produce your own music or do you have someone help?
For that album, I did kind of like a first cut where I produced everything. And then I worked with my bud Sahil to kind of like give it like an extra a little producer's pass. He did like some production zhuzh and then a mix. And then
mixed it up,
baby.
Yeah.
Now I have gotten really into the production side of things. Mm-hmm. And so the last song that I released, I did it all, which felt really good to just be like, oh, I can make something that sounds quote unquote professional.
Right.
And that happens entirely by me in my bedroom.
In your studio.
Yeah, my quote unquote studio.
In the studio.
Yeah, in the stew.
In the stew.
It feels really good. I just like really like being self-sufficient.
Totally.
I think a lot of musicians do.
Totally.
It's such a personal thing. Like you don't want anyone to put their hands in it. As someone who writes, like I get it when you're like, I have this whole idea. And then someone's like, let me help you with that. And you're like, all right. And like maybe they actually do make it way better.
Yeah.
But especially if it's coming from such a personal place too, you're like, okay, this feels like slightly invasive when you're having someone. You just want to be able to say, I did this whole thing.
Especially something that was so personal and precious
as
that one. Sahil, I let in because I was like, I know him. I trust him. We talked about it and I was like, I really feel like
he gets the vision.
He really sees it, both sonically and also just the idea of it. He like really saw it. But that's rare. I was just talking to my friend about like, sessions. I was like, do you usually come in like with something you want to work on, or how often are you just coming in raw? And he was like, I come in raw every time. And I was like,
that, we're gonna keep that.
Sorry, actually,
that.
Yeah. Oh gosh,
that's just the one soundbite we used to promote the
damn
episode.
Damn it. But I was like, really? Whoa. And he was like, yeah, it's because like you never know how a session's gonna go, and the worst thing in the world is if you have something that you like, and somebody is like bouncing off and you're not clicking with it, and then you feel this weird obligation to like keep it. It's a really hard thing to have bad collaborations.
So you gotta go in raw.
Gotta go in.
Do you play shows?
This is a cool stupid thing about me. I've never played a show.
Okay.
Ever.
I love that.
I've never played a show.
I love that.
Thank you for saying
just
that.
Just because it's so unexpected. Is there a reason?
Yeah, there's a couple reasons.
Okay. Do you want to share them?
Sure.
Is playing live even interesting to you?
It's interesting to me. There are definitely some times where I will like go to friend shows and be like, you know, looks fun and kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like I bet they're having a good time. And this is, I think maybe is something I'm like changing a little bit these days. But like the album that I most recently did, very maximal. Okay. Every song has, and hopefully you can't tell, but there's like 9 guitar parts in every song. And all of the tunings are different.
Right. And how do you replicate that?
It would be so incredibly hard to get anything that felt like an actual like live rendition of it together.
Do you play instruments?
Yeah.
Or do you lean on a lot of like Ableton plugins?
I'm a very out of the box kind of guy.
Okay.
So most of what is on that album is live track guitars.
Okay.
That's like the kind of bread and butter of it. Because I think I just grew up on bands mm-hmm. more than a lot of other people. I was one of those Radiohead kids.
You're a Radiohead kid. Oh, I love Radiohead.
I was a Radiohead kid.
You don't have to grit your teeth
for
that.
I don't know.
You know, I
things
go
through phases. I feel like maybe, I would say about 6 years ago, maybe it was like if you were super into Radiohead, you had to keep it hush hush.
Yeah.
But like now we've gotten now we can circle back around. We can go back. Yeah. Now it's fine.
Yeah. I'll come out as it. I was a Radiohead kid. I am a Radiohead kid. I feel like I grew up in kind of the golden era of Pitchfork. Mm-hmm. So I was also like a Pitchfork kid.
Yeah,
it meant so much to me when I was younger. I remember when I was 17, I truly read, I think,
I mean, it was so formative. If you were into music,
it was 2010. I think I read probably every single review they ever did and listened to every project. Like I was just so obsessed.
Wow.
And so encyclopedic about it. And I think in that era, you know, it was like kind of the tail end of that, like, meet me in the bathroom sound thing, which is very like live band,
absolutely,
kind of vibe. So I have always loved,
those are the best years of my life,
the best, as good as it gets. And it's funny, that book mm-hmm. is like sub caption like the golden era of indie rock or something, like mm-hmm. in New York from 2001 to 2010, and I moved to New York in 2011.
Oh,
kind of devastating.
Big L for you.
Big L for me. But I have always gravitated towards live sounds. But, and maybe this is kind of a weird pairing, and I think it's kind of like maybe the hallmark of my sound, I love things that sound very generated in a studio and are not sounding like, oh, a recording of a live band.
Right. Oh, yeah, good.
So I think a lot of the sounds that I make are either hard to do live or don't make sense. I think I make a lot of headphone music, basically. It's like you put on cans mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be like lush and wide, and you're supposed to like sink into it, and like that's
lay
the
on
experience
the floor.
That, exactly.
So this is building off of this. Uh-huh. One of my hottest takes is that I don't like live music. I don't like going to shows. I love to go to support my
Ruby
friends.
Has a lot of hot takes that we have to edit out of the
here's the thing.
Okay, wait, let me...
I'm gonna say it. I actually don't think that's that hot of a take, and here's why.
Good, go.
Here's why. I feel like you go on these little apps, you go on like a Hinge.
Mm-hmm.
And you see somebody, what I order for the table, live music. I don't think that's probably the exact question that they're answering.
Yeah,
What would it be? My hobbies include, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'll fall for you if you like live music.
Yeah.
Those people suck.
Right.
For me. For me, almost without fail, anybody that 100%. Says that, they're picturing like a bad blues band.
Totally.
Too many horns.
What I'm thinking is just what you were saying, where you're like, I make music that... my saying this completely is discounting how amazing it is to be in the same fucking room as like your favorite artist. Of course, that's
one of my favorite things.
It's incredible.
And some shows are amazing.
And you're like, no, like, of course.
Shows have changed my life.
I've been to great live shows.
Ruby's worst nightmare is a music festival.
Really?
You should see me at a music festival.
I'd rather
festival.
I get like a root canal than go to
you're
like,
more on this than me.
I feel my bad.
But my greatest live experience was like seeing Bon Iver perform at Boston House of Blues when I was 17.
Sure.
And I was like on the balcony. All my friends were like, we're going to go down there. I was like, and I was
away
from my friends at the top because I was like, I don't want anyone near me. And that's not like moshing music anyway, but I'm like, I don't want to feel crowded.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so good. And his band, they're so good live. I remember thinking they sounded as good as they sounded when I would play them like on my
speakers. It's always a special thing when some band can like put that together.
It was so well done.
And that is the thing with my own music where I'm like, I know that's not happening unless I spend a lot of money. And so I'd rather just not.
I also just don't love feeling squished. An experience to me has to be so controlled. And I don't like the, I don't like going to live shows where you can't see and you're like squished and there's some guy who's too tall in front of you and then you have to go pee and then you go pee and then you can't find your friends by the time you come back in the bathroom. All of those take away from the experience where I'm like, I just wanted to hear this amazing music and I can just do that if I lay on my floor in my house.
Yeah. When I was younger, I was like, every band I've ever loved, I have to see them live. And now I am like, oh, there are certain types of music that functions really well in a live environment and I'm down to go. And it's usually things that I'm like not all the way precious about.
Right.
Things where it's like, oh, that just sounds fun.
Right.
Like mm-hmm. people are going to be dancing here and I'm sure there's going to be a good energy.
Yeah.
But then there are some where I'm like, this is like my favorite shit, but like this lives in headphone land. Mm-hmm. And there are some times when it's like, to be in a crowd can be like a really satisfying thing.
Totally, which is something maybe younger. My anxiety is like the biggest thing that's at play here. Is it's just the underlying tone of everyone is like.
For me, I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. The only thing I did as a young adult was drive around to different cities in the South and see music.
I don't think my parents would have let me do that. Mm. So I think for me, because also I lived like one town further away from my high school than everybody else.
Yeah.
And I was always driving and I would always pick people up. We'd go wherever and then I'd drop people off and then I'd come home. And I always had that 10-minute drive at the end of the night. And that was always like the most special time. Mm-hmm. It was me driving home, 2001 CRV, late at night. And I have my little special music. And so like that was my formative music listening.
In the car, which is also maybe the best place to listen to music.
Like, yeah, as good as it gets.
My God. But for me, it was like seeing music, seeing live shows. It was like my life depended on it because I felt very out of place where I was from. And shows were like the ways to connect with like-minded people. Like a natural filtration system for me. So
did you meet, so you met a lot of people at shows?
Tons of people.
I don't think I've ever in my life gone to a show and been like, oh, I met somebody cool there.
Oh, stick with me, honey.
Damn.
We're meeting people, especially when I was young. I had no problem chatting people up and stuff. For me in Tennessee, my sister had like kind of the same trajectories, like where we found our friend group through our music taste because it was the Bible Belt and God and Guns. If you found someone who liked the same band as you, it was like a lifeline. It was like such a large part of my story as a young
kid. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I didn't have any friends that had the same music taste. And so my music, I don't know what possessed me to care so much, but I really did. My music taste was so much like discovered in solitary. Like it was me at home on my little MacBook reading Pitchfork in dialogue with nobody. And so like music, I think for me was such a like internal personal practice and not an external thing, which I know is atypical. But then when I went to school in New York, I was like, it's finally going to happen for me. And I remember I showed up to New York wearing like billowing khakis and a like Deerfield baseball t-shirt.
I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on the billowing khakis.
You're like standing outside of Webster Hall and you're like,
yeah. No, I had like cargo shorts. Like I was like a mess. I was a mess. But I showed up to New York tragically unhip and like made all my music friends, but had this like really beautiful realization of like, oh, I'm so behind. I'm so incredibly lame and...
But I think wow. I think moving to New York does that for everybody. I moved there 1 year before you. Mm-hmm. I had like my whole idea of like my identity. All the friends I made when we all moved there the same year when we were 18 in 2010. And the way we dressed and how we spoke and what we were into. And then it was like a year later we had been like New Yorkified. And suddenly it was like we were cool. And like we just were because we lived there. We knew what was cool. We knew what wasn't cool. Mm-hmm. And like I think you take that part of you with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Where you're have like, you? Because how long have you been in LA now?
2 years.
Oh, you're fresher than I thought.
Yeah.
I thought you were here longer. Because I've been here for seven.
Seven. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have started to like shed my New York skin a little bit.
Ooh, okay.
I had this whole life philosophy, which I meant to come up with a name for it that's not stupid, but I never did. And the stupid one has stuck and has worked for me. It's this thing called no vibe is off the table.
No vibe is off the table.
And I had this realization maybe when I was like, I don't know, 24, 25, somewhere around there, where I was like, so much of my identity right now feels sculpted by what I decided was cool when I was 19.
Right.
And it's like, if you think about that on paper, you're like, ew.
Gross. Yeah.
And so I was like, let me maybe actually like revisit that possible.
Let's reevaluate.
That 19-year-old me desperately trying to be cool in New York didn't have all of the right value systems or right answers or right aesthetics or whatever. Oh, yeah. And so I have been doing this thing ever since where I'm like, I've just like acknowledged in myself to participate in something once or even a few times does not mean you have to like inherit that into your identity. And so if somebody is nice enough to invite me to something, even if it doesn't seem like my vibe, so to speak, I'll show up and I will like
dip your toes in.
I'll participate like full throated. I'll participate.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and not be self-conscious about like
full throated.
Is that not the right term?
I don't know, but I love it. I'm going to adopt that.
Yeah, the fact that nobody in the room recognized that has me thinking.
Have you heard of a full-throated? Oh, okay, okay.
One person in the room had it.
So half the room.
Hell yeah.
Full-throated. Not so right now.
It sounds kind of sexual.
Oh, it's so sexual. It.
Yeah, okay.
Full-throated, go with
raw. Damn it.
Got it. Okay, keep going.
This is going horribly for me. But yeah, I'll like participate all the way. And I'll be like, I'm not going to be self-conscious about like what this means for me. I'm just going to like see, does it land? And that has been so wonderful and eye-opening. And like there are certain things I think that I'm up to now that New York me probably would have scoffed at. But I feel like a lot more like complete, and like my version of myself feels a lot more like handcrafted.
Well, as you get older, you realize that kind of pretentious behavior doesn't serve you. I feel like when you're flexible and you're open and just like you were saying, like full throating, it's liberating in a way. And you always have these experiences that at the end of the day, I think are really valuable.
Yeah. I also had like a fun lesson on it with boundaries. I think that like I learned through this that I used to hold like a lot of margin on boundaries. And I think that was because I didn't know what they were very well. And I didn't feel a lot of confidence in my ability to like articulate them or to enforce them. And so if something was not trespassing a boundary, but was like adjacent to it, where it was like, oh, that might be close to where my boundary is, I'd be like, I'm out of here. And I feel like now I'm a lot more comfortable with those kinds of things. So like, I'm like, oh, let me see what it feels like around the margins.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I always struggled with, I had the opposite problem where I wasn't good at enforcing boundaries, so I just did.
They just got trampled on?
And I'd be really uncomfortable. And I think when I would attempt to articulate, like, not wanting to do something, I think when you're young, too, like, I realize how much easier it is when you're, as an adult, to be like, I don't want to do that. And people, for the most part, are like, cool.
One of the coolest things.
When you're, like, 20 and your friend's like, we're going to this warehouse. We're not going to bed until 4 a.m. You're going to love it. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. Everything you just described sounds horrible to me. Right. And I'd end up going, but I wouldn't do acid with everyone because I didn't want to. So like I could hold my boundary on like not ingesting things, but like I would still end up
when it came to ingesting.
Yeah, like if they're like, open your mouth, I'm like, absolutely not. But like you all do it, and then I'm like, cool, it's sweaty, this is so not my type of music, the strobe lights are giving me a migraine, I'm not having fun. And the next day everyone's like, see, aren't you glad you came? And I'm like, no, I'm actually not glad.
I
wish I had stood my ground and been like, I don't want to go. And also, that's okay. And you guys can so go. And I'm not like lame for not wanting to go the same way.
Totally.
Like, you know, but I think there's like the self-judgment.
I remember I had like, 1 year where I was like not in a going out vibe. Yeah. Just, like, it wasn't my year for it.
Right now.
Yeah. And I remember on my birthday, I told all my friends, like, I want y'all to go out on my behalf. I'm going to stay at home.
Yeah.
Oh my God, for your birthday?
Yeah. Y'all all go out and celebrate. And
they went out. You're like, go party.
I'm going to stay home.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay home. Now I go out a lot.
Yeah.
It's all, you know.
Yeah, it's the ebb and the flow.
It comes and goes.
I think everything that both of you guys said is just valid. I would have, like something like Burning Man. I used to mock
That's such a classic example for this.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great example. Like I mocked it for years.
Are you a burner now?
I can't even claim such a title because I've only been once and I only went for 3 days.
But did you have a good time?
I had the greatest
time. It makes sense that you...
I also can respect how that might be someone's worst nightmare. I thought it was kind of going to be my worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. And just like in any experience, you can be surprised.
I also think we have to make the clear distinction between something being like, it's not for me, but I don't think it's bad. Just building off of that is just that it's like, you can totally be like, Burning Man is so not for me for these several reasons, but I don't judge you for going. I think you probably will have the best time, and that is
awesome. I don't judge you for not going.
Right. And I think that just comes through maturity. Mm-hmm. Paige texted me last week being like, after all this rainfall, all the mushrooms are like growing, do you want to come foraging with me? And I was like, absolutely not.
Hell fucking
but I love
no.
you so much. Have the best time. Like, it's just not for me.
Sure.
But I would go on a walk through like the swampiness and like put on some proper
shoes.
I'll go
foraging with you.
Okay. Yeah, you guys go. Yeah. I'm just like, I don't want to dig in the dirt for mushrooms because I don't care.
What do you think about this though? Because I find this to be like a fascinating thing to reflect on. Okay. So we are a collection of narratives, right? That we tell ourselves. And we reinforce those narratives. Like, oh, I'm so bad at this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bad at asking for directions. I'm bad at X, Y, or Z. And then sometimes when you examine these things, you're like, is this actually true? Or is this just a narrative that I've continued to tell myself? And could I actually be good at this?
I think they're extremely powerful.
Right? We are. our thoughts.
Yeah, that was actually kind of like one of the first things I was going to say is like the reason I think I got to my job is because like my sense of narrative of that was so strong. Mm-hmm. Mm. I think that like your brain has certain ideas that it holds very dear, and then it will do whatever mental gymnastics it needs to prop up the really dear things. And that is ultimately like what shapes your perception of the world. It's mm-hmm. like, how can I move through the world in such a way where these things that are really dear to me continue to make sense? And it's rare that you dismantle those.
You know, it's so interesting that you say this, because I was literally journaling about this the other day.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, what are the things in my life that have propelled me forward? And I think about, for me with writing, every setback I perceived as like character development. I was like, oh, this didn't work out, and I'm going to go through this, and it's going to make me a better writer, or I'm going to become a more interesting person because I had to struggle. Mm-hmm. And I like, that was the way I viewed it, as opposed to viewing it as like, this is evidence that I'm not meant to do this. Oh, this
because
is just making me
you
better.
You have already made the self-determination.
Right.
I am a writer.
Mm-hmm. Whereas with us, it was like, that was locked in. Then I was looking at like parts of my life where I have taken the opposite approach and viewed setbacks as like, oh, see, it's too hard, and this is why I shouldn't do it. And this is evidence that it's not right for me, or I'm not good at it, versus like, why don't I just apply that to more things in my life that I want to achieve? And I think that's, I've done that in like relationships with dating, where I'm like,
I had this one wild breakup where like the thing that my brain wanted to hold on to was like, this relationship is right and is good for me. And it was not, like, I was not being treated especially well, but like, because that was my thing, I was doing the requisite mental gymnastics to make the rest of the world make sense, with that being the kernel of truth. And then when we got into breakup lands, like when it got there, the thing that kind of like made me realize it was, I was like, oh, the world around me, in order to prop up this truth, which is actually a falsity, has become like novelistically improbable.
Right.
Like, I was going crazy, because in support of this thing that wasn't true, trying to make it feel true, I had to make so many other things seem different than they were.
Right.
And that's,
and that was wild to just be like, oh, I feel normal, I feel rational, I'm in dialogue with my sense of self, and yet I am crazy.
Right. But that's even more of a reason to keep our narratives flexible.
It's really important, I think, to check in with them.
Yeah, to check in with them. Because when you do that, and you cling on to a narrative that might not be completely true, it's even more devastating when you have to rewire your brain. And
Yeah. It gives me a lot of like empathy, I think, for people who have certain worldviews that I maybe don't agree with. Like, for instance, I think a lot of boomers have trouble with the concept of privilege. And I think that's because for a lot of them, their kind of like central nugget is like this notion of the American dream, and the idea that they deserve what they have. And so if you're going to try and convince them of the idea of something like white privilege, they're like, oh, I have to then attack my central thing, which is the idea that I deserve this white picket fence that I currently have.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to ask somebody to do that.
Totally.
I had this friend who I love very dearly, who is getting, I don't even remember the name of it, some religious PhD thing at Yale. They're very smart.
Hot.
And they're very insightful. But they said something about religion that really shook me in the best way, which is just that all that religion is ascribing any amount of weight to a narrative, which feels really true. And it's nice to be able to just be like, oh yeah, that's not so scary. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think most everybody goes through the world with their own narrative, and they give it some weightiness or some sort of like, yeah, there's something kind of cosmically true about this. And like, that is, I think, what really, really drives people.
It's so true. It's like, whether it's spirituality or astrology or religion, call it what you want. It's the same thing. It's almost like we decide what is true and then look for the evidence versus having the evidence.
For sure. That is how we work.
Right. And that's
just
like
how humans work.
It's like, I can tell you we're doing some of that at NASA too. Shouldn't be, but
it's like, we're deciding that like Mercury is in retrograde and shit's going to go to hell. And now I will look for everything that backs that up and like validates that idea.
Totally.
And so it's like, God is doing this and I will find reasons for it. It's just, and so I think it's interesting when we point fingers about like, that's so ridiculous. It's like, we're all as ridiculous and as not ridiculous as the next.
Exactly. Yes. I have this very goofy term that maybe y'all can use. I like to use the phrase, if somebody is like, because I get a lot of astrology stuff, and I'm actually pretty cool with astrology. Mm-hmm. I kind of vibe with it. Mm-hmm. It's fun to me.
What's your sign?
I'm a Pisces.
I'm a Pisces rising.
Oh, wow.
We'll yeah, I have a very watery chart. But, you know, sometimes like people will say something where I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And the phrase that I have taken to is like, oh, that crossed my woo-woo threshold.
That crossed my woo-woo threshold. Yeah. That's really
It's like
funny.
A nice kind of like light way to be like, hey, FYI, like was with you, you no longer me. With you.
Love you.
Love you. Celebrate you. Believe whatever you want to believe. That's exactly where mine kind of ends.
Right,
right.
And so just know you can speak about it freely. Believe whatever you want to believe.
But I'm not.
Whatever. Just so you
I'm no
know.
Longer,
I'm no longer like all the way with
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
I love
that's
that.
Totally fine.
I think that's a great. Yeah. I think that's a great phrase. I'm going to totally use it. And I think about it. It applies to so many things. Like when people want to talk about like government conspiracies, and then they're like,
Yeah.
That's why the Earth is flat. And I'm like, oh, you lost me. Like sure. I'm with you. Like the government totally. Is. They lie about shit. Of course. Yeah,
sure.
They've admitted to it.
Sure.
But
the thing is that I think is like fun to realize about that is like it's such a spectrum. It's not like it's you're woo woo. Oh, you're terrible.
Yeah.
It's you know like I have my own threshold.
Yeah.
And somebody could say about the things that I say, oh, that crosses my woo-woo threshold.
Right.
Just
right.
as I can say that too.
Someone else.
Everybody falls.
Or you don't have enough woo-woo for me.
That's another way. Yeah. You got to elevate your woo if you want to hang with me.
You're too far from my woo-woo threshold.
You got to boost those numbers.
Yeah.
Those are rookie woo-woo numbers. I think I have like maybe second year woo-woo numbers. I'm not a rookie, but.
It's actually insane what's happened to me. Like the woo-woo's got me.
You got got?
I come from a family of doctors. And that like shaped a lot of my belief systems.
Sorry, I had to just take a picture of what's happening that you can't see from here. Stop! My feet!
Babe, don't post it to the internet.
Ruby's taking pictures on my feet
again. My WikiFeet rating right now is 5.
I'm not posting your shit.
You have a rating on WikiFeet?
Sorry, I interrupted.
I know so little about the world of WikiFeet. Tell me about it.
Is it called Wikifeedia?
I forget when.
This whole episode is now going to be you talking about WikiFeet.
I was shocked that I had a profile on there. And what was more alarming is that there were photos of
my clear,
feet.
Somebody made this profile.
Anyone
right.
can pull
But some
photos
human
of
person
my, someone made
was
it,
out there.
And then other people contributed to this,
oh, it's, this
by
is
uploading
a,
pictures of my feet.
It's a committee job.
So this is what was
it.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Half the photos on there, I'm like, where did they even get these pictures from? It would be from like a distant friend's stories where my feet were in the back. It was shocking.
I also wasn't aware that there was such a... I understand about foot fetishes for sure. Like I knew that that was a thing, but I didn't realize it till we were, I think, in Europe this summer when we were all outside. I was the only one wearing socks with mm-hmm. sandals and everyone else was in like really gorgeous like open-toed sandals and I was in Tevas with socks. And I took a picture and everyone was like, don't post that. And I was like, wow, your feet look beautiful. And they're like, exactly.
We feet keep.
People are feet
keeping.
We're
not posting
to
your
feet.
Question then on the
it could be my
keeping.
Fault that your feet are on the internet.
Are you
so
feet keeping because you're like, oh, I could get good money for that?
I worked a foot fetish party
yeah.
with my friend who is psycho. She was like, I found this thing on Craigslist. We're going to make a bunch of money. And I went. I was 23 and mm-hmm. like, fuck it. No boundaries, you know?
That's right.
And mm-hmm. I went to this thing and it was in a spa. It was like after hours. And I wore a costume so that I would be unrecognizable. And we're going to probably have to edit this out, but I let guys suck on my feet for money. And I was there for 3 hours and I made $500 and just let strangers suck on my toes. Guys weren't like jerking off, but there was no penis involvement and no like, it
like
was
if you were a real one, we wouldn't edit this
mouth
out.
Mouth to foot. I think it was just a lot of people who were like felt shame about their fetish. And so there's no critique on them. I just felt weird. The next day I was at Whole Foods and I thought I saw a guy at the hot bar who was sucking on my toes the night before and I was like,
sure.
This is making me too nervous. I don't think I can do this again. It's also illegal. So I was like,
I'm
not gonna do this again. But I did do it, made $500 and
what's illegal about it?
It's sex work. It's considered sex work.
If someone sucks on your toes?
It's like, because you're not getting taxed on this. It's like you're going and like letting strangers suck on your...
Doesn't it depend on the state?
It's like me saying, oh, if you fingered me and then Venmo me $10, you can't go to jail. It's like, well, for sure. But it does fall in... It's being organized by people who are putting out flyers
sure.
and luring girls to come to this thing to dress slutty and let strangers suck on their feet for money. And then we
sure.
had to pay them out a certain amount when we left. It's a business that is not
Got
being
it.
Taxed, you know?
Hell yeah. I think that's cool. I also think, sidebar, that must mean so much to those people.
Hell yeah, you know, like, they had a great
time. The idea of being like, oh, I have to live in the shadows my entire life. But then there's like this one night where I'm like surrounded by my peers. And for once, I get to feel like a normal person.
Right.
Yeah. Probably really cool.
But guys were like, can I take a picture of your feet? And I'd be like, for $30. And they would just like take a picture and they'd hand me $30 cash. And then like another guy would be like, can I get a picture? And I would be like, for $40. And he'd be like, okay. I was making money like cashing out.
Wow. Yeah, people love feet.
I've never
gotten into that. I don't really get it. It was kind of gross, but I was like, yeah, you can suck on my toes, yeah. I feel like, should we end on this note? It's been like a little over.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Brendan, you rule.
You're incredible, so cool.
Thank you so much.
We love you.
You are so great.
You're perfect. So
thank you. We are definitely going on a JPL tour with you.
100%.
Yeah, we should do that.
And we won't.
I would really love that.
Anything in the parking lot afterwards.
Yeah.
We're off the record now.
Big winks. Yeah, yeah.
No, we're still recording, babe.
I'm trying to.